Why is Diane on my mind? Understanding the state of the economy. The economic story of the year so far has been inflation. In June, the country's inflation rate hit the highest level in 40 years. Then came news the country's economy shrank for two straight quarters, stoking concerns of a recession. At the same time, we're looking at one of the hottest labor markets in history, which the Biden administration says is proof the economy is not as bad as many Americans think. So, what does all this mean? Damian Paletta is the deputy business editor at the Washington Post. He joined me earlier this week to walk us through these economic indicators and what we can expect in the coming months. Damian, we've seen lots of economic data that seems to point us in so many different directions. First, the job market. Walk us through what's happening there.
Sure. So the job market is, you know, almost single-handedly keeping this economy going. We've had more than a year of essentially 400,000 new jobs a month. So the last month, you know, we have data now that shows that over 500,000 jobs were added. And that's just a tremendous run. It shows that companies are continuing to eagerly hire and that Americans are eagerly going to work. And maybe they're coming off the sidelines. You know, maybe they waited a bit after the pandemic to see what was right for them, or they're getting a job that's better for them for whatever reason. It's better pay, it's more flexibility, that sort of thing. So the labor market is smoking hot. Wages are going up. People are getting better opportunities. Companies are having to pay more, which, you know, is one of the things that kind of flows through to the inflation data that we're seeing. So I think, you know, if not for the labor market, we'd be talking about a much different economy right now. And I think there was a point where we thought they were starting to see cracks in the labor market. Companies were talking about, especially technology companies, talking about slowing hiring, maybe freezing hiring. But, you know, that concern is several weeks old now. And we're seeing the stock markets even snap back quite a bit from those concerns, you know, in June when the gas price is really high. The economy's kind of regained its footing, and the labor market's been a big reason for that.
At the same time, you've had lots of people leaving the labor market altogether. The pandemic sort of changed their outlook.
Yeah, I mean, it was this kind of great reevaluation that many Americans went through. And it, you know, that's what's amazing. There's more than 100 million Americans who work. Everyone's got their own deal. Everyone's got their own kind of equation that they're kind of balancing, whether it's their family, their health, their happiness, their joy. And so I think the pandemic made a lot of us kind of reevaluate what we wanted to do. Now, maybe that, you know, I have a significant other or a family member who's immunocompromised. I just can't be putting myself out there. Or maybe, wow, I'm going to do that thing I always wanted to do. You know, I've been making widgets for 20 years, but I've always wanted to write a comic book. I'm just going to go for it. So everyone did this kind of reevaluation, some with great success and others didn't, but they kind of gave it the shot that they always felt like they owed themselves to take. So now we're seeing a little bit of a rebalancing. Some people are saying, okay, I gave it a shot. I'm going to do what, you know, makes more sense in a different economy. But, you know, we were seeing this tremendous number, and actually the numbers are still quite high. Millions of Americans quitting their jobs every month. Which, you know, if you're an employer is disheartening, but if you're a worker, it's great because you're quitting your job to go do something that you'd rather be doing.
Right. What is it?
That could be staying home, you know, or that could be maybe you've done enough to retire and you can retire early, or maybe you say, I want to do a job that I've always wanted to do and now's the time to do it.
So what is the relationship between the strength of the labor market and the health of the economy overall?
That's a great question. I look at the economy as kind of a domino effect. And, you know, consumer spending is the biggest part of the economy. You know, obviously there's all these companies that make investments and stuff like that, but at the end of the day, consumer spending is the biggest part of the economy. So if you have a job, and right now the vast, vast majority of Americans, essentially everyone who wants a job has a job. If you have a job, you're going to continue spending money. You're going to continue, you know, going to the grocery store, you know, fixing your flat tire, doing things like that. When you lose your job, which is what happens, you know, around a recession, then you start making tougher choices. Now, obviously, people now are saying, hey, you know, that hamburger is $15. I'm not buying that. I'm going to buy a chicken sandwich. Or they're making individual decisions based on inflation, but they're still spending money because they have a job. So when the labor market is strong as it is now, people are going to continue spending money. Now, how much money it is, it sort of depends person to person and the circumstances, but they're going to continue spending money, which is going to keep the economy going. Once we see kind of layoffs, that's when that domino effect begins. People say, whoa, 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 we can't go on that trip. You know, I might not be able to fuel up my gas tank, so we can't go to grandma's house this weekend or something. That's when you see a lot of things happen that pull the economy back. But as long as the labor market is strong, and people have jobs, and they're getting, you know, raises, whatever those raises might be, they feel like they can keep going, and the economy is going to keep going, too.
What about inflation, which so many people are worried about?
You know, I think it's one of the things that was the most surprising results of the pandemic. You know, the government did so much, companies did so much to rescue the economy. And so all these things happened at once. You had workers reevaluating what they wanted to do, and they were able to demand better pay because companies were desperate for work. So that, you know, led to wage increases. You had a supply chain crisis that was happening all over the world. It was really difficult to get products, cars, whatever. It was hard to get anything, even like, you know, beef and chicken and eggs and everything else. So those prices went up. And then you had, you know, an economy that was flush with cash, and people were spending money on things they hadn't spent on before, but they were cutting back on things, you know, like travel and pumping it all into like new couches because everyone was at home. So there was all these like weird things happening in the economy at once. And so it led to inflation. And what the Biden administration made the mistake of, and quite frankly, the Fed made the mistake as well in 2021, they thought this was just going to be a short-term phenomenon, that inflation was going to, you know, be kind of part of this reentry pain that we had coming out of the pandemic. But then there was all sorts of other things that happened, like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which sent oil prices skyrocketing, which drove gas prices this year, you know, in many places above $5 a gallon. So there's all these different things that happened at once that fed into inflation. I think we're all stunned at how long it has persisted. There's signs that it's starting to ease. Obviously, gas prices are down, you know, more than a dollar a gallon just in like 6 weeks, which is great. The more, you know, I think people want it to go down a lot more. Some prices also seem to be easing a bit, but, you know, I don't think we're ever going to go back to where we were. And so the question is, well, there's a couple questions. One, you know, where rate will it settle into? Usually inflation is like around 2% a year. It's something that Americans can kind of live with. Is it going to settle into like a 4.5% or 5% a year thing? Like, that's going to be a harder thing for us to stomach. And what can the Federal Reserve do to address that? Do they have to raise interest rates? So are our mortgages going to go up as we try to like wrestle with inflation? The other question is, politically, what is the legacy of inflation going to be? You know, clearly the Democrats are on a bit of a roll, kind of out of nowhere with all these bills that they've been passing lately. You'd think that would help them kind of energize their base. But obviously, inflation is a huge concern for everybody, you know, Democrats, Republicans, you know, everyone's confronting this every day. And so whether it's going to be a huge political force in November, it's maybe too early to tell, but there's signs that both parties are clearly taking it very seriously.
Now, this may be Monday morning quarterbacking, but what about the fact that last summer, Larry Summers himself urged the Fed to begin raising interest rates, and the Fed, according to Larry Summers, has waited too long?
It's always really hard to know. And it's actually really interesting to hear the Federal Reserve explain their thinking. It just so happened that in that period when he was urging them to raise interest rates, the labor market looked like it was starting to cool off a bit. And job growth, it seemed, was not as strong as we had hoped, and we were worried about a double-dip recession. And so, of course, what happens a few months later is they revise the data, okay? Diane, they add back like millions of jobs out of thin air. So the labor market was actually much healthier than it looked like at the time. And the Fed was just working with bad data. And so I think, yes, in retrospect, the Fed has even admitted that they waited too long to raise interest rates. It's a really tricky thing to know how to turn the dials because, you know, if you get it wrong, you smother economic growth and then the layoffs begin, right? And then the people stop spending money and then it like gets so much worse. So what they're trying to do, what they said is like have this perfect landing and have this perfect landing where we get, you know, interest rates up to cool the economy, but not to like pour a bucket of water in the economy. And it's something that, you know, the jury's still out on whether they can pull it off.
But now that the job market has shown such a major upward trend, at least the last jobs showing, what does that mean for the Fed? Will they continue to boost interest rates, or will they scale back a little bit?
So the jobs numbers come out the first Friday of every month at 8:30 a.m. Not to be too inside baseball, but just to explain what we go through. And so the jobs numbers come out at 8:30 in the morning. The stock market opens at 9:30. And so we have this great jobs report, and then the stock market immediately goes down. And so you're thinking like, you know, what's going on here? This should be great news that the economy is doing better. But investors are saying, oh boy, the Fed's going to raise interest rates now because the economy is doing well, which means it's going to slow growth and these companies, blah, blah, blah. So the stock market, actually, it's come back up since then. But, you know, I think with what the new jobs data shows us is that the Fed can raise interest rates, which it's been doing since March, without hurting job growth. And so, you know, they've been really aggressive the last two times. They've gone, you know, 75 basis points each time, which is like almost a full percentage point twice in a row.
Right.
And so if they know that they can do that without leading to big layoffs, then they can feel confident that what they're doing is working and it's not, you know, really harming the economy. Now, they can't do that indefinitely. They meet every 6 weeks. There's going to be a point when, you know, the balance is going to be perfect, and then a point when maybe they go too far. But they seem confident right now that what they're doing is working, and they need to continue it because they really need to get inflation down for the economy to be healthy in the long term.
Have you ever been able to sit in on a Fed discussion?
Yes, actually, I have been in Fed. They have open meetings about like bank regulatory policy, but they don't have these meetings, these FOMC meetings, as they're called, the Federal Open Market Committee, every 6 weeks. They are closed because they want to be able to discuss, you know, sensitive things in the moment. They release the transcript years later, but these meetings are kind of private. But I've been in the rooms and I've seen the big long table and the chandelier when they've had the meetings about other things. You know, it tends to be very, well, at least the public ones, cordial and deferential. A lot of these things are kind of worked out in advance. There's not like surprise Perry Mason moments, as people have been talking about recently, because the Fed chairman, in this case, Jay Powell, really wants consensus. But I mean, I can see with issues like this, where they could get it wrong and it could have drastic consequences, someone like Jay Powell really needs to be working the phones in advance to see where everyone is, see what people are hearing in their districts. What is the Boston Fed hearing? What is the San Francisco Fed hearing? What is the Cleveland Fed hearing? Because they might all be hearing different things. You know, the manufacturing sector might be going through one thing, but the tech sector in San Francisco is going through something else, right? So
right.
He needs to really understand everything that's happening at once.
What a tricky balancing act.
And everyone's a critic. I mean, it's, you know, you've got the smartest people in the world, you know, collectively making these decisions, which is great. But, you know, they're encountering something that they've never seen before. You know, the Fed's been around, I think, since 1919. It was created right after World War I. They've been through all these things. You know, they've been pressured by multiple presidents. But they're in this situation now where they're trying to get it just right. They're dealing with inflation for the first time on this scale in 40 years. And there's so much at stake. You know, the decisions they make on these little numbers, these little dials that turn, affect, you know, households and the conversations around dining room tables all over the country. And so I know they're putting a lot of effort and care into getting it right.
One thing I wish you'd explain to me and to us is the GDP, the gross domestic product. It's something I don't really understand what it measures and what the numbers tell us.
So every quarter, we measure the growth of the economy and the size of the economy. The economy, the U.S. economy is, you know, more than $20 trillion. And, you know, we make stuff, you know, physical stuff. We sell goods, we sell services, you know, like there's all kinds of things that go into our economy. And, you know, you're asking a great question because on the one hand, we have this super hot labor market, 3.5% unemployment, 400 to 500,000 new jobs a month. It could not be hotter, okay? No one had ever dreamed of such a thing. Then on the other hand, we have an economy that has contracted for two straight quarters, okay? In the first quarter and the second quarter, the GDP, the economy, shrank. So that should tell you that the economy is in bad shape. Now, whether we're in a recession or not, people are going to argue about. And, you know, what is a recession? That there's different definitions of that even. But the fact that the GDP has contracted for two straight quarters is the kind of thing that suggests an economy that isn't necessarily healthy. Now, there's all these reasons why the economy is contracted. In the first quarter, there was some weird glitch that had to do with inventory stockpiling before Christmas last year because of supply chain concerns, and all that stuff, all that investment was pulled into the end of 2021. And so there wasn't as much at the beginning of 2022, right? So that's like a kind of a fluky thing that happened. And then in the second quarter, you had a surge in gas prices, obviously, in June. A lot of companies started preparing for a recession, which, you know, slows investment down, and Americans started getting rattled by inflation. So there's all these kind of things swirling around that, you know, more than $20 trillion economy. And, you know, whether we're in a recession or not, I think that's this thing that really smart people are looking at now, but it's hard to tell because, like you said, on the one hand, we have this amazing jobs market that no one's ever seen before. But on the other hand, we have GDP that is contracting and has contracted for two straight quarters. So, you know, I've been doing this a long time. When people ask me about the economy, I kind of throw up my hands. Everyone's got their own economy right now that they're experiencing, they're dealing with, their own bills they're paying, their own decisions they're making. I think they know when they go out and see restaurants are full and you know, people are spending money. And quite frankly, when gas prices went up, people kept putting gas in their car. You know, like if people stopped traveling, then it would have changed behavior. But people like seemed resilient. And a lot of these inflationary effects, people are continuing to spend the money. And until they stop, I think, you know, the inflation is going to remain elevated, but the economy is going to keep going.
So that brings me to whether thoughts about the economy become a self-fulfilling prophecy. If people think it's bad, they're in the dumps and they pull back. If they think it's getting stronger, they move forward with these purchases and going back to work. So what are they to make of?
Absolutely. You're 1,000,000% right. The economy is incredibly psychological, and a lot of the decisions made by consumers and by businesses are psychological decisions based on what you think is going to happen, right? You're not going to go buy a new car if you think you're going to lose your job. You're not going to go, you know, redo your kitchen if the stock market just lost 10% of its value, okay? You're kind of like trying to gauge what you think is going to happen and how it affects you. And also what you're hearing. If you hear the word recession all the time, you're going to start getting nervous. Maybe you're not going to quit your job and become that comic book artist that we desperately need right now, but because you feel like you can't risk the health insurance consequences of it. So there's a lot of people making their own calculations based on what they are feeling and seeing on their own. And whether that leads to kind of a big change in consumer behavior, we'll find out soon. And that could bring us into a recession or prevent us from going into one.
Surely people at the lower end of the economic state are going to think more pessimistically than those at the upper end.
Oh, absolutely. You know, lower income Americans are the least able to dodge inflation. You know, they're the ones who have the fewest choices when it comes to putting gas in their car. You know, maybe that means they have to take a bus that gets them to work in 2 hours and they can't do it, right? They're also the ones who probably don't have the flexibility to shop around for groceries or, you know, to try to, like, they have to make these consumer decisions that are kind of built into their lives, and so it's much harder for them. They also might have the least flexibility in terms of job hopping, although we did see initially a lot of lower-income Americans had the most benefit because these jobs that were, you know, really kind of clinging to minimum wage started paying much more than minimum wage to attract workers. So there was some initial benefit to the lower wage workers, but they have a really hard time escaping inflation. Whereas, middle income and kind of upper income Americans, it's easier for them to kind of absorb some of these higher costs because they've benefited the most from the stock market increase and things like that.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Damian Paletta. So, Damian, what are the economic indicators that you're keeping an eye on?
Well, great question. I mean, we're obviously watching the inflation data closely. There's going to be month-to-month changes, especially when gas prices are kind of jerking things around. But if we get a sustained retreat on inflation, I think that'll be something that's positive. The stock market the Dow has gone up 3,000 points in a couple months. It did crack under 30,000. Now it's back around, 33,000. So I think that's something that's gotten the people to calm down. One of the things I'm watching the most closely, though, to be honest, is University of Michigan puts out this consumer sentiment data, and it gets to right at what you were talking about a few minutes ago about people's feelings and about how people feel about the economy. That number has been really low lately. I think the two lowest readings ever are in the last couple months. And so if that number starts to come back, if people start to feel a little bit better about the economy and less panicked about inflation and more sure about their own personal condition, then I think the economy, has a chance to kind of emerge from this, in a healthy place. But if people continue to remain really down and are worried, eventually they're going to stop spending money.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that's going to really kind of potentially pull us back and make this, in some cases, kind of a messy winter.
So politically speaking, who's going to benefit, Republicans or Democrats, if the economy gets better or stays as sort of crazy as it is?
I think that's a question that we won't really know the answers of until early November. But I would say right now, if the labor market remains hot, it's something that Democrats desperately need. Is they need people in their jobs to feel comfortable, like they can continue to put food on the table, they can continue to put money away for their kids' college account, they can save for retirement, that sort of thing. As long as the labor market stays hot, Democrats can exhale. If the labor market comes back, if there's cracks, if the layoffs begin, Democrats are in big trouble. Now, inflation is not going to get resolved in a couple months. Inflation is going to take, a year or more. And like I said earlier, it depends on what we settle into. If we come down from 8 or 9% to like 4 or 5%, that's a pretty, elevated number that we're not really used to in this country in terms of a normal and inflationary pressure. But if we come back down to like 2-3%, that's something that might feel a little bit more digestible. So I think it kind of depends on where things go. If it's status quo, If we head in November with, you know, this kind of weird inflation conundrum, but a really strong labor market, you know, I don't know the answer to that, who would benefit politically. But if one of those things goes in either direction, I think either party could try to pounce.
What do you think the government could do now to help this situation?
We've seen some state governments give money, essentially write checks, both Democrats and Republicans, try to just give cash to Americans in their states to help them absorb some of the costs, the higher costs from, you know, things like higher gas. And while you completely understand the political impulse there, when people need money for things, you give it to them, it actually ends up making inflation worse because then they go and spend the money on the things. What the Fed's trying to do is like lower demand, take money out of people's pockets, make it more expensive to borrow. And if state governments just go ahead and just turn around and give people money, it just makes them spend more money and drives the prices back up. So, you know, it's tricky. I think, you know, what you should look at, we should look at as a country, the things that are the prices went up a lot and maybe they didn't need to. Maybe there was gouging. For example, things like housing. You know, the price of housing and rent has gone through the roof, okay? And it's not like we all of a sudden got 100 million more Americans to compete for the same apartments. We're kind of the same number of people. Unfortunately, the number of available housing did not go up. And so there was this weird, huge jump in the housing prices and a huge jump in rent. And so I think that's the kind of place where having, you know, a government voice, a conversation about what's going on and what could be done to address it would have been helpful. But instead, you know, the housing market is kind of this weird thing where there's municipalities involved and states involved and the federal government has a role. And so nothing was really ever done. And prices went through the roof. And that's something, as you mentioned earlier, for lower income Americans, it's impossible. They have to live somewhere, right? So they have to pay the rent. And so I think there's specific areas where the government could have kind of focused on having a conversation. The Biden administration obviously tried to do a lot on gas prices because it was like a, you know, a huge mess when it was just going up 10 cents a day. And they tried to essentially flood the oil market with extra oil. And it did work. Gas prices went down, although they're going to have to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So there's individual things they can do. But on inflation as a whole, really, it's only the Fed. And they're doing everything they can at the moment. And it's going to take a while to see if it works.
So finally, what about the Inflation Reduction Act? Is it really going to reduce inflation?
It's kind of, you know, Trump-level marketing in terms of the name of it, because it's really a climate and drug price bill. And it could certainly have an impact on energy prices and drug prices over time. So I'm not trying to take away from it, but, you know, the name of it, the Inflation Reduction Act, kind of speaks to the concern of a lot of Americans right now. And it's kind of, you know, brilliantly designed. I don't know how effective it's going to be in terms of whether people will agree with it. You know, the Republican critics of the bill say it's not going to help. In fact, they criticize that more government spending will be going into things like electric vehicles and things like that. Democrats argue that certainly energy and drug prices are two of the things that are of the most concern to Americans. And what this bill does is try to invest tremendously in clean energy development and incentivizing electric vehicles, among other things, but trying to make pull Americans back from fossil fuels and to make, to, you know, remove a little bit of our dependency on fossil fuels and make it more attractive to invest in other things. And so, obviously, we were all stunned to see what happened to gas prices. If we can shift more Americans into products that don't consume as much gasoline and it brings energy prices down, Democrats would say that'll be a win for everyone. That's on the climate and energy side. On the drug side, it makes it easier for, or allows Medicare to negotiate drug prices. And that's supposed to bring down drug prices, which is a huge concern for people who have that gobble up a lot of their savings. Democrats didn't get everything they wanted. They obviously wanted to make even more changes to the insulin prices, which affects millions of Americans, but that piece kind of got stopped. But in these areas, which are big concern to voters, it could have an impact. Now, it might not have an impact immediately, but it could kind of bend the curve, and who knows what kind of happens after that. But it's something that I think the Democratic Party has tried for years to accomplish, and it was finally able to pull it together you know, essentially by the skin of their teeth with this 50-50 majority.
Right. So it's going to take a long time.
Well, I don't think it'll take too long of a time. I mean, I think, you know, and I just don't want to make Americans think that their drug prices will come down in a matter of weeks. I think when Medicare is authorized to begin, you know, negotiating drug prices, I'm not exactly sure when that'll start, but I imagine it'll be soon. That should have a pretty quick impact on the price of drugs. So I think this is something that we'll start seeing changes afoot pretty soon, but it's not like going to bring people's prices down by the holidays necessarily. And the same with energy. These investments are going to take years to get, you know, the infrastructure invested in, to have companies ramp up the production of electric vehicles. I mean, there's new incentives for consumers to buy electric vehicles, but you can't even get them right now. I mean, there's so much demand for them that there's a multi-year waiting list essentially for like the new Ford Mustang electric car. So I think it's going to take some time for the inventory to kind of match the demand. But once it's there, you know, we could see a much different fleet of cars on the highway in a couple years, and the government will have played a role in that.
Damien, thank you so much.
It's always my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Damien Paletta. He's deputy business editor at The Washington Post. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.